You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome all you weirdos, residents of Sentinel City and its surrounding suburbs, and everyone living inside a crystal, which is inside another crystal, which is somehow also inside the first crystal. It is time for your 95th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your Weird Science podcast family. I am your ragtag host, Jason, broadcasting as always from the Wrong Turn Studio, perched high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And joining me from the Xavier School softball field's dugout is my pal, Ruben. Hey, Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Good, what's up?
Oh, just a couple of books to talk about today. We have two books that should be, you know, in theory, really big important books. They are Fall of the House of X, number 4, the penultimate book of that, you know, peak series, and the final issue of Dead X-Men, number 4. So why don't we get right into those and see what we have to say about, first, Fall of the House of X, number 4, The Term. It is written, of course, by Jerry Duggan, art by Lucas Wernick and Jethro Morales, colors by Brian Valenza, letters by Travis Lanham, designed by our favorites, Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. We open up with a quote, which is, you know, a thing that we used to do all the time in these X-Books. This one is from X-Men Red, number 7, Magneto's Death Scene. He says this to Storm, "Promise me you'll watch Charles," which is appropriate for this issue because Charles does something a little sketchy, maybe. But we'll talk about that for sure. Now, structurally, this issue's kind of a mess, and thematically too, but we'll get to that. We're going to split this issue into two parts. First, we'll talk about Apocalypse and Krakoa and all that stuff, and then we'll go back and talk about everything that has to do with Charles and the X-Men and Nimrod and Orcs. So, first, Apocalypse and Krakoa. The thematics here have some people a little bit upset. It calls back to probably one of the best issues of this entire era, at least one of my favorites, one of the most memorable, one that our old buddy Chris and I talked about a lot. That is X-Men number 7 from the run written by Hickman himself. This is the issue that introduced the Crucible. Remember how that Crucible worked, Ruben? You a big fan of that particular concept?
I love when people kill each other, yeah. Just for... But there was a purpose behind it, right?
Absolutely.
You know, go out on your own terms and come back your better self kind of situation, right? So you fight whoever, and then when you're killed, you'll be reborn with your mutant powers back.
Yeah, it was all about trying to undo M-Day, because that's when the Scarlet Witch said no more mutants and just erased the powers of tons of mutants, including Melody Guthrie, who's Arrow, and Callisto, one of the Morlocks. So Hickman gave us this ritual at Crucible where a depowered mutant could earn the right to jump the queue to rebirth, not having to wait to die to be reborn, because when you're reborn from these eggs, you got your mutant power restored. But you have to earn it through battle. So Melody Guthrie was killed in the Crucible by Apocalypse, and later in Marauders, Callisto was killed by Storm. So yeah, a very dark concept, but one that made this twisted sense in this new Krakoan reality, and that was one of the first ideas that made us think, maybe Krakoa has this real dark side that maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be, which was really fast. Back to the current day, Apocalypse and a bunch of mutants from Arako have arrived on Earth to join the fight against Orcus, and the very first narration box here calls them, quote, a ragtag team, which annoyed me right from the start, because let's talk about some people on this ragtag team. We got Apocalypse, okay. Rogue, Gambit, Bay the Blood Moon, John Ironfire, and SZA of the Storm. That's a hell of a team from any book. I don't care who it is. I mean, sure, you also got that weird little lizard guy from Chicago with the W flag, maybe. But, you know, your A-listers are there, not a ragtag team.
Yeah.
We still don't know who is writing these narration boxes. Is it going to be that reporter guy who now owns the Bugle? Always forget his name. But I have a bone to pick with him.
I also thought it's like pretty much the entire war party from Arako, right? Back to your point, sides. Like that's not a ragtag band, right? That's like an entire nation state of like Omega level mutants.
A lot of the big players from both sides of the Genesis War are coming down to kick Orcus's ass. Ragtag team. Okay. A tiny, tiny little point, but right off the bat made me not like this book.
Yeah. New York Yankees are a ragtag baseball team, right?
Don't bring up the
scruffy.
Oh, this ragtag team makes its way down from orbit. Remember, they were up in orbit, so that the two different space stations could make cross swords in the sky. They've somehow come down from space, and they're starting to kick Orca's ass. We see Apocalypse rescue Krakoa by taking down a Stark Sentinel single-handedly, which, okay, I buy that. He's Apocalypse. Apocalypse versus a Stark Sentinel. The Sentinel's going to lose. No problem there.
Not the one from Trials of Magneto, though.
Maybe.
Because that one was facing down Storm and Magneto. And
once again, we think quality control means a little varied, maybe different production lines, different places. One's unionized, one's not. I'm not saying which is the better one. Yes. You know, some Stark Sentinels are more equal than others.
You either need a mutant human circuit to pierce their armor or just a sword, but Apocalypse.
I mean, Apocalypse can, like, manipulate all sorts of matter in crazy ways, right?
Magic, doesn't he have
that power?
Yeah.
I'm fine with Apocalypse. but the problem remains that Krakoa, the mutant island who walks like a man, is dying. Apocalypse says he's starving, and it has been established for decades that Krakoa feeds off of mutant energy. It got so strong in this era by taking tiny, tiny bits of energy from all the mutants who live there. Kind of like taxes, but less painful. But in this state, Krakoa needs stronger stuff. It needs actual blood. So Apocalypse enacts a twisted version of the already twisted ritual that is the Crucible. He will fight mutants in single combat right here, right now. The blood of whoever loses, hint, it's not going to be the mutant named Apocalypse, the loser will be fed to Krakoa. First guy to volunteer is a character invented for this issue. He is Kintar, and his thing is he's old. He wants to go out with a bang. So he fights Apocalypse. Kintar uses heat vision on Apocalypse. It's not very effective. So Apocalypse punches Kintar into a fine red mist for Krakoa to drink up.
Did you hear me?
The second volunteer is... well, it's Wrong Slide. His story goes back to X of Tens. The mutant Rock Slide died in Otherworld, and when he was resurrected, that's when we learned about how mutants who die in Otherworld don't come back as themselves. Which is what's supposed to give that whole event stakes, put true death back on the table. Wrong Slide has had a few poignant moments since then, especially in X-Men Red. Wrong Slide says to Apocalypse, "I am mutant energy." Which Wrong Slide is, and Rock Slide was, basically a stone golem controlled by a psychic being that is inside. So that's like the real true mutant is the psychic being. So I suppose that's what he means by "I am mutant energy." The idea here is that maybe Wrong Slide is by himself, potent enough to just fuel Krakoa, and if he dies, maybe nobody else has to. They fight, Apocalypse wins, and Wrong Slide's last wish is that, quote, "If you see Rock Slide again, tell him it was so good to be for a while." Idea is that Wrong Slide is not suicidal. He's not doing this because he wants an exit. It's a sacrifice for Krakoa and his fellow mutants. And his energy does seem to be enough at least for Krakoa to wake up and for Apocalypse to say, "Let us return our island to its home." So what do we think of this new version of the Crucible and using it to restore Krakoa? Any thoughts there, Ruben?
It seems like a really inefficient way to do something that you seem is important. But, I just kind of like rolled my eyes. It just felt like this is another effort at Duggan trying to grab the stuff that happened during this era and repurpose it for his story.
Which, in theory, I like the idea of, you know, closing the loop on things, calling back to the stuff that made us so excited at the beginning. But it always feels like a cheaper, dirtier version of what we got the first time around. Uh-huh. Which, I suppose, you could say that's on purpose, that we're now showing that, yes, Krakoa was a mistake, all sorts of compromises had to be made, and now we're putting that front and center. All the things that were kind of hidden, we're revealing this is the dark underbelly that made Krakoa work. That's me trying to be super generous here. I think it's just kind of gross, and it's a shame to see Wrong Slide go out this way. It feels kind of like we had to clean up the extra Laura, we had to clean up the extra Beast, and now we're kind of taking this whole Wrong Slide thing and killing him off so we can bring back Rock Slide maybe in the next era. So yeah, not my favorite thing. Now on to the even more controversial part of this book, which is largely about interactions between Charles, Cyclops, and Nimrod. When we left off here, Cyclops and Nimrod were on the moon in the old summer house habitat, and Nimrod had just murdered Dr. Gregor to death by twisting her head around. Now, Magic with a K shows up to teleport Cyclops away just before Nimrod explodes the entire habitat. So we will not be seeing this set used again. A narration box tells us that Nimrod can be in multiple places at once, which strikes me as Duggan just giving himself a get out of jail free card to play against continuity nerds. Like, oh, you can't say that he was here, so he can't be there, because I already told you he can be multiple places at once, which is very, very, very convenient.
Yeah, we kind of knew that, though. We've seen that before. He splits into different duplicates of himself.
I guess so. I'm being a little cynical.
But this is, I guess, the way they're going to explain the lesser and greater thing.
I thought that was just a different timeline situation.
Yeah, I thought that was a better explanation, but I fear that they're not going to address it, and now they're just going to
kind of retcon it.
Do it this way, yeah.
So now we get to that Sentinel City thing, which I thought was supposed to be the big bad to take us to the end of the series. We get some small panels of Sentinel City rising to space. And more importantly, we see Charles Xavier, who we last saw, you know, shooting Rachel in the back in that no place. Now he's hanging out in Orcus HQ with Omega Sentinel. Seems that Charles is offering her a deal. Charles's facial expression here, very funny. It reminds me of that meme of the kid who puts a cup ramen in the microwave without any water. Like, I know this is a mistake, but I'm doing it anyway. Also, Charles here looks incredibly buff, like He-Man levels of buff. I know, you know, he's reborn as a sexiest self and all, but I don't think Charles Xavier should just have giant bulging biceps and abs. Big broad shoulders, that's not my Charles Xavier. Sure, have him be fit, but I want to see him, you know, go toe-to-toe with Hulk Hogan. We next get a classic example of a data page that should have just been comics, which is a phrase I used to use a lot, haven't used much lately, but here we go. Charles's deal is that the Orcus AIs will allow the mutants to live in peace in Krakoa, and that in exchange, the mutants will not resist or interfere with the rest of the actions of the Orcus AIs. Whatever they want to do, we're not going to get in your way. And they bring up the Red Triangle protocols. And I guess the point here is that even Professor Xavier, who's making this deal, he couldn't even force quite everybody through those portals on the Gallonite. Most of them he could, but not everybody. Some of them will be able to resist. I get that part. But the bit I don't understand a little later on, we see Emma, you know, with the rest of the X-Men on the space station, I guess. She says that the few humans left in Orcus are now using the Red Triangle defense. What's going on with that? I really don't understand. Do you have any? Can you clear that up for me, or is it just really a mess?
Yeah, I cannot. I don't know how they would learn this technique and then implement it across their organization so quickly.
Right. So first off, who even are these remaining Orcus humans? Right. Haven't the AIs just totally come out in the open and just said, you know, we're against, you know, kill all humans is what our thing is now. So I don't know who's still hanging on, you know, trying to get to their, you know, 2 weeks away from the pension or something. And I guess that Xavier can just psychically implant this Red Triangle defense in them, which usually it's like, oh, you have to study and work and learn how to do this. But I suppose you could say it's psychically implanted. And who are they employing this defense against? Is this Xavier telling Orcus, okay, I know I can't command you AIs anyway, but now I'm also going to show your people how to resist me, I guess. But I just don't see what's going on here. It just seems very confused. But the important point in story is that Xavier's made this deal with Orcus, and the rest of the X-Men, through Emma's psychic abilities, kind of knows, oh, this must be Xavier working with Orcus, because otherwise, how would these people know the Red Triangle defense? I think that's the main point that Duggan wants to get across. So Charles now has a psychic chat with Cyclops, one of his very first five students. This psychic chat happens on a mental image of the old Xavier School's softball field. It specifically says softball fields, which has some people on the internet very upset because, as we all know, the X-Men do not play softball, they play baseball. So there's a lot of speculation. Is this a mistake? Is it Duggan not knowing X-Men history, which I don't think is the real thing? Is it somehow a signal that, oh, this is Xavier showing Cyclops that it's all a trick because, you know, this image is wrong and that's a hint that everything's not quite right. But it does give Cyclops the opportunity to yell at Charles some more before Cyclops uses that same Red Triangle deal to end the conversation. This is also when, to prove to Orcus that he's really making this deal, honestly, I mean it, Charles uses his psychic powers to make some people on a U.S. nuclear-capable military spaceship self-destruct. So here we got to stop and talk. do we really think that Xavier is sincerely making a deal here? Or is he just trying to play for time and pull a shenanigan? What do you think?
I would assume it's a shenanigan, but I don't know why anyone would trust him. And I think this baseball thing is just a mistake. I don't think it's a clever signal.
Yeah, I don't know about that at all. I could read that both ways. But I do agree with you that I can't imagine Xavier's honestly making this deal. I'm trying to make this version of Xavier tie together with the one we've been seeing on the other side of this event in Rise of the Powers of X and related books.
Yeah, this kind of made me mad because I was like, is this just... It seems like Duggan's whole story has been like taking everything I like and making it worse. And is this like his... Yeah. Like, oh, I'm going to take Kieran Gillen's Charles and like now put him in my story. Like he came from that timeline to this timeline and did this. Like, is this the whole, you know, the harder path that he chose, right? The not murdering murder a child path.
So where does this fit in the timeline? Do you think this is happening after he shot Rachel in the back and he started up on his whole Phoenix thing? Or did this happen before all of that? It must happen after, because I can't see Rachel would not have gone along with this. The other people, you know, around him, the dead X-Men, if they knew about it, would not have gone along with it. So I think this must be happening after after Rise of the Powers of X number.
They should have at least coordinated the uniforms, right? Like that's what really throws me off. I looked for the spinal whatever design on the costume, and this is not that, right? It's Charles.
And I looked all over an editorial note. You know, somebody's saying this happens before this or after that, because I'm trying to understand what his plan is. And to know that, I really need to know when this is happening, because things change so fast on the other side of the book, other side of the event, that trying to figure out his mental state would really help me know, okay, what in the world is he doing? So do we think he really killed those U.S. military guys on the ship, or did he, was there some sort of a smoke screen and now they went through, I don't know, a gate, a magic teleportation stepping disk? They're safe somewhere else, I would guess.
Right? No, I think he killed him. I think he killed him.
Oh. Well, we'll have to see. I'd bet that we're going to see them safe and sound in the next issue or two. That's my guess. But yeah, I don't know what Xavier gets out of this, because it seems that his whole Phoenix plan is progressing, you know, completely separate. I mean, literally in other dimensions and time and space. So I don't know what he's trying to get Orcus to stop doing here.
Well, you've got the AIs with their Sentinel City, right? And we'll get to that in a second, but it sort of looks like they have a plan to eradicate all life on Earth. And it seems like the deal here is eradicate all life except for mutants, and we'll just kind of be off on our own.
I guess, but I don't know how that would even work. We'll get to Sentinel City in a second. I don't think this plan is very well thought out. Maybe we'll find out more about it next time, and maybe it'll make more sense. So back to the Sentinel City stuff. Sentinel City has never really come into focus as the major threat that I think it's supposed to be. But I guess it's doing something to use solar radiation as a weapon against Earth. What's going on here with Sentinel City? It looks like in some panels, it looks like it's like a quarter as big as Earth itself. The scale, the physics, I think are all wonky. But what is it doing?
Yeah, I think it's just a giant magnifying glass. So it's taking some sun and focusing it into like a big solar beam and then just burning big swaths of Earth, which... You know, I don't think we'll ever see this again. Like, you see it actually blasting the Earth. You think, even though it gets stopped briefly, there should be some dead spot.
We don't see any effects of it on Earth, do we? We see some people around, someone in the apocalypse side of things says, oh, the sun's going nova. But we don't actually see any effects. So I don't feel like, oh, this was a major threat. I don't know what it was supposed to do. I don't know what it's doing. And then it doesn't last very long. I think, if the plan was to kill all life on Earth, then wouldn't the mutants just have better luck, just go back to Mars, which was Orcus's deal way, way back when at the gala? Maybe they just should have done that. That would have been Charles's better deal to make, is, hey, we'll go back to Mars. But like I said, it doesn't really matter, because Manifold, remember him, he just teleports the entire Sword Station, or asks the universe to do this for him. However it happens, the whole Sword Station gets teleported into Sentinel City, presumably destroying its whole weapon system, you know, as soon as it comes online. And as the book ends, we get a few panels of the X-Men inside the wrecked Sentinel City, fighting against Nimrod and Omega Sentinel. And I do have to say, the art on these particular pages does look very, very cool. Even though I don't really care about the fight, because it feels like it's just filling a few pages. I mean, so we have, you got to have like the Cyclops blasting against Omega Sentinel. You have Nimrod being attacked by Rogue and by some other X-Men characters. And I don't really see why we care about this other than to kill some time. And then on the very, very last page, we see that Storm, recently back from helping to resurrect Magneto, she's flying through space on her way to kick some ass herself on Sentinel City, and we get some more really bad physics. And I try to overlook these, but the narration boxes says that you can, it's usually you say, oh, you can't hear anybody scream in space. It is said that in space, screams go unheard, which is just different enough from the aliens poster to not get sued. However, that's untrue. If one is able to cocoon oneself in oxygen and lightning, then blister across the void in a solar tempest. So Storm, if she's screaming, she can hear herself. I buy that. But you'd have to have the oxygen connecting the person's ears who's hearing. It's a cool-looking page, and they clearly want to end on, oh, Storm's a badass again, but it's just kind of silly. And that's the book. You got Apocalypse using blood magic to restore some life to Krakoa. You have Xavier making a deal with Orcus. Maybe, probably not. And then you have the X-Men destroying Sentinel City before we even really got to see what it was. And in 1 month, we'll get the fifth and final issue of this series. So overall, the series just feels like there's, I think I've said this before, there's no arc to it. There's no rising and falling. There's no, oh, which way is the battle going now? It's just a bunch of stuff happening. And yeah, I'm really surprised that Sentinel City is off the table so, so quickly. It was built up, and then it's just a dud. I had expected we'd see it in the last issue, but what is the big fight next issue? Any idea what our big conclusion, what our big climactic battle is going to be? What's left?
You gotta have Storm punch something, right?
I guess it's just everyone against Nimrod and Omega Sentinel. But between now and this last issue, we will have an issue of Rise of the Powers of Ten, and we will have three issues of X-Men Forever in between.
Do you believe that Omega Sentinel's a threat at this point? Hasn't she been disabled like five times with like...
just an EMP right near her head, and yes, she's out.
Yes, yes. And even which Nimrod, like at times he was a big threat, and at other times he seemed to
wrap
be
him up in some amber that Krakoa can now spit on him again. That'd be fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe it's a big Phoenix thing next time. Maybe Phoenix gets powered, although Phoenix has not been foreshadowed in this title at all.
Nothing's been foreshadowed in this title.
No, it's just a series of stuff happening. There's no real feel to it. So I don't even have a number written down. I guess I'm going to go with 4.5 out of 10. Not a great book.
I give it where a special at? 5, but I think special it's pretty five. Special bad. it's such a
disappointment for that this amazing era of storytelling is kind of going out in not such a great way. Oh well.
I just want to like pretend none of this happened, right? The other half of this event has been interesting, but this has convinced me that Duggan was not the right person to succeed Hickman as the X-Men kind of head.
It hasn't writer. Been our favorite. We'll go that far. Moving on to our second and final book. It is Dead X-Men number 4, which is called Hyper Ballad. And I've only belatedly realized that that happens to be the name of a Bjork song. And all four of these issues have been named after Bjork songs. Earth Intruders, Army of Me, An Echo, A Stain, and now Hyper Ballad. So there you go, Bjork. It is written by Steve Fox, who's apparently a huge Bjork fan. Art by David Baldion, Bernard Chang, and Vincenzo Caruto. Colors by Frank Marin, letters by Corey Pettit, and design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. And if you're wondering, do I really need to read Dead X-Men? Do I have to just follow all the intricacies of this plot to understand what's going on and Rise of the Powers of Ten? The answer is...
It doesn't matter!
It doesn't. Not at all, not even a little. But the thing is, if you do sit down and read these books, I'm not going to tell you whether it's worth the money or not, that's up to you, but you're likely to have a pretty good time. It's a decent amount of fun.
Yeah, it doesn't annoy me, but it's certainly not essential.
Absolutely. That's a good way of summing that. So do you remember back at the end of the first issue of Dead X-Men, when I noted that it seemed like, hey, the mission of this team appears to be already complete? These goofballs were resurrected, and the team was created for one reason only, to be sent through the Moira engine timelines by Rachel Summers, find a living human version of Moira McTaggart, have Prodigy scan her mind for a map of Moira's complete life history, bring all that info back to Professor X. And they did that in issue 1. We saw Professor X use that information in Rise of the Powers of 10, issues 2 and 3. So for all the impact this series had on the larger event, it easily could have been a one-shot, or a data page, or just had Professor X already know where young Moira was hanging out. It's not like that was a huge state secret, right? She's born in the same place all the time. She can't change anything about that until she kind of gets grown up and has the power to influence events. But Steve Fox threw in a wrinkle so he could pad things out into a miniseries. In the process of getting that information from Moira, the team accidentally allowed that version of Moira to obtain a chunk of Mysterium, the final ingredient she needed to complete this axe that allows her to travel through her own entire history, maybe go mess things up in her very first life in some ill-defined way. Issues 2 through 4 exist only to have the team clean up the mess they made at the end of issue 1. So yeah, not vital, not important, but fun enough. I know over on the Weird Science DC podcast, those two sad sacks hate fun, but once again, the official position of the Weird Dose of X podcast is that fun is good, and the series has been a decent amount of fun. Now, one thing I didn't think about until I was about to open this issue is, how is the team going to get around between timelines, what with Rachel being dead and all, having been shot in the back by Professor X at the end of Rise of the Powers of 10, number 3? And it turns out that's not a problem. The entire issue of Dead X-Men number 4 takes place between pages 14 and 18, that's 5 pages inclusive, of the Rise of the Powers of X number 3. On page 14 of Rise, Rachel learns that Xavier plans on killing young Moira, which she knows at the beginning of this issue of Dead X-Men. And on page 18 of Rise number 3, Rachel makes a speech to Professor X, a speech she also makes on the last page of this issue. So yes, everything here between pages 14 and 18 of Rise number 3. Well, we should be able to get through the plot fairly quickly. At the end of the last issue, the dead X-Men and Axe Moira both showed up at the same moment near the end of Moira's fifth life. The dead Xers seem to be in trouble, but then Rachel, who isn't dead yet, yanks all of them out of that timeline, including Moira. Rachel has a psychic chat with Moira that places this during the action of Rise number 3, right after she learns about the whole Charles killing young Moira plan. Rachel then tosses everyone, X-Men and Moira, back into the Moira engine timeline where this Moira originated, right back where they found her. It's 2.something, it doesn't really matter. There was the one with the older versions of Abigail Brand, which we were so happy to see, with Sunspot and Juggernaut. Moira kills Dazzler, but then Dazzler comes back to life because, yeah, that's something Dazzler can do. Which goes back to a Chris Claremont storyline from New Excalibur in 2006 that was never really resolved. Steve Fox tries to make sense of all this. He explains that Dazzler does auto-resurrect after death, but when Nimrod killed Dazzler at the gala, that somehow made her just a little bit too dead to resurrect. Like, there's like mostly dead and all the way dead. It's very, very Princess Bride. He's trying desperately to make sense of this messy part of Dazzler continuity. It's just never going to make sense, but I don't blame Steve Fox for this. I kind of blame Chris Claremont. I think it was one of the times where he set up this idea, and I think he quit before it was resolved, and it's just been hanging out there for 20 years. So now the rest of the dead X-Men beat up on Moira a little. Orbis Stellaris tries to ascend, but fails because, duh, Enigma's already there blocking his way. It is nice to see the Orbis Stellaris attempt to become Dominion. Now, Axe Moira is finally finished off when Juggernaut jumps on her, I guess from orbit? He was up in a spaceship there with Sunspot and everybody, and he smashes both her and her magic axe into teeny tiny little pieces. That taken care of, time to wrap this series up. Rachel, who's still not dead, she yanks the dead X-Men back to Atlantic Krakoa inside the White Hot Room, and then explains Xavier's whole changing plans and, you know, lies, basically, to them. They each get a little moment to say why the Krakoan era was important to me and why I don't want to see it wiped away. Rachel tells Prodigy some mumbo-jumbo about how all pieces of the Macron crystal are effectively the whole crystal, and the White Hot Room is inside the crystal, and so when Prodigy brought the crystal inside of itself, it, quote, formed a circuit. Now, circuit is a big word in X-Men books lately. I don't see how it applies here. Any idea what the Macron crystal is doing inside itself, and why that matters?
I read that and I was like, okay, if this actually matters by the time I get to the end of the book, I will try to figure this out. And then when we are told that none of this matters, I'm just like, okay, this is just hand waviness.
Something had to happen with the crystal because it was lodged in Prodigy's chest the whole time. So we knew that MacGuffin was going to have to pay off. And in the fight with Moira, it does kind of like attract pieces of itself, interact with other pieces of the crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
something about there, bringing everything to everywhere, but I don't know what that does or means.
Somehow it gets very much, it proves that every person is important, and that's why we can't wipe away Krakoa.
Yeah.
Again, Steve Fox working really hard to try to make this book important, and I think it just doesn't really work out. So here we are. We have Rachel with the dead X-Men make that psychic phone call to Xavier, and she makes that speech about how you can't kill Moira, can't undo Krakoa, and all the dead X-Men are involved, and that's where this book ends, like about 2 minutes before Xavier shoots Rachel in the back. It's right there. Very odd little miniseries. I do think it was a clever enough idea to write a story about the X-Men team that was killed as soon as it was announced, but it meant that writer Steve Fox had no input into choosing the team. He had to kind of just take it as a whole. And this team was only created to be killed off. So I don't think Steve Fox really had much use for most of these team members. None of them got much in the way of characterization. Ruben, pop quiz, can you name off the top of your head all five members of this team?
See, Dazzler, Prodigy.
Dazzler. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to look. I guess the answer is no.
I guess yeah. We got Dazzler, Jubilee. And Prodigy, Jubilee, Cannonball, and that one really strong lady who's Frenzy.
Okay, yeah, I would never.
Again,
that
they
one.
Didn't really matter. They didn't get a lot of, but they were on panel, but they didn't have things to do as specifically themselves. They were just there to be the X-Men team that was here in this book while Moira was doing things. So I think
who's watching
was the weakest
part
of the book. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious who's watching Shogo, Jubilee's kid.
Is he? Last I knew, he was still a dragon. I gave up on that Excalibur book.
Yeah,
Excalibur book.
You it probably something terrible happened Shogo. To the
good
dragon,
question.
But.
Where is Shogo? That's a really good question. I'll have to look that up after recording. So yeah, I do wish Steve Fox had made these characters feel like actual characters, even if he didn't choose them. Show me why they mattered as individuals, and that didn't happen.
I also thought Orvis Stellaris's ascension, right, when he goes up and gets blocked, it was sort of the kindest, like, non-splatty version of the failed ascension.
Yeah. And we didn't get to see his, like, mental interaction with Enigma, because we've seen that before, and I guess yeah. We didn't need to see it again. We knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
I can't imagine someone reading this book without having read everything else. This is not a good first X-Men series to read for your new comic reader. Don't do this one.
Yeah.
I did enjoy this kind of last, assuming it's the last, look through all of Moira's crazy lives and timelines, like that. I like the variations of the art styles throughout those crazy lives and timelines. So I'm going to be pretty generous here. Give this kind of silly little book a 6 out of 10. It's completely
exactly
inessential, but kind of fun.
I was worried about where you were going when you said generous. It's a 6. It's fine enough. Again, the stuff like trying to explain Dazzler's pseudo-resurrection ability is nice, but I don't believe that anyone's going to really rely on this explanation, right? So,
and there's not even really an explanation. It's just, yes, it works, except when it doesn't. Because she didn't resurrect after the gala, and that had people asking questions, and this just says, yeah, that is weird, isn't it? That's all this really amounts to. So we don't know why she has this power, how it connects to any of her, you know, Dazzler-like powers. It's just out there.
The most important thing they could have done with this series is get me a new Abigail brand. So I'm actually going to follow them through the portal or something. And they didn't even do that, so.
Well, she's still hanging out in the 616, and I forget what they called that. Was it just somewhere else? Somewhere secret? It was super vague, and we never got back to her. I can't imagine that she's going to show up now at the end of the Krakoan era, but I would love to see her pop up again in From the Ashes.
Now that the Fisher guy is dead, nobody's there to feed her, so I'm kind of worried.
That is a problem. That is a problem. Steve Fox, by the way, he does have another X book lined up already. It's a series that feels like it kind of got caught between eras when they kind of wrapped up the Krakoan era quickly and they're changing editors. And this feels kind of stuck in between. This book is called X-Men Heir of Apocalypse. That's Heir, H-E-I-R. So it's Apocalypse kind of choosing his successor in the whole survival of the fittest thing. I'm not sure where he's going. I'm trying to avoid solicits that give away too much of the plot, but he is choosing an heir. Do you want to hear the candidates?
Sure.
They are Armageddon Girl. I don't know who she is.
No, she's not Cable. There.
I'm not sure which Cable, but Cable's on the list. Cypher. Okay. Emma Frost.
Cypher. No, Exodus. Won't be Cypher.
Forge. Gorgon. Mirage. Mr. Sinister, which, that's curious because I thought he was dead. Penance. Richter. And Wolverine, Laura Kinney version.
Okay, so the answer is it's Richter. He's the successor.
That's the one that stands out to me. Yeah, I was going to say any guesses, but that's got to be that, right? Because that's been who was his little protege for early on in the whole other world stuff, learning the magic. It's got to be Richter. I'll be surprised if it's not Richter.
I got to say, though, those are a bunch of characters I actually like. So, darn it, Armageddon Girl fan?
You have any more Armageddon Girls?
No.
I don't know who she
is. You got me, man. But skip the Armageddon Girl. But, like, go with the other characters.
Everybody else, yeah.
Yeah, there's some good characters in there. Not Richter, right? I'm not a huge Richter fan. But you named a bunch of people that I'm interested in. So, yeah, I'll check that out. Yeah,
the first issue of that is going to be released on June 12th, which is a week after the big Uncanny Number 700 End of an Era celebration. So we will need something to review that week. So yeah, I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about that. But before that, next week is a big week with a lot of books, including two by our man Kieran Gillen. Those books are Avengers Number 13, finishing off that two-issue tie-in, Wolverine Number 48, continuing that endless Sabretooth War. Then we have X-Men Forever Number 2, and Rise of the Powers of X Number 4. And those I'm very excited for. I expect and hope that we'll find out more about Professor Xavier's Phoenix plan. I don't expect that we'll learn about what his plan is with this little deal with Orcus. I can't see Kieran Gillen crossing over with that. If it does, it explains. I'll be very excited, but I'm not going to count on that. But I am very much looking forward to kind of all four of those books, but especially the two Kieran Gillen ones. And that's all we have to say for this week. So, Ruben, until those four big old books come out in a couple of days, or depending on when you hear this, maybe out already, what do you think our fine listeners can do to pass the time?
I can do what I'm going to do and try to find the Armageddon Girl origin issue.
Armageddon Girl miniseries? That's what we're going to read. Have a good day, everybody.